Before the term maverick became a political cliché, it was often attached to composers like Charles Ives, John Cage, Morton Feldman, Steve Reich, and John Adams. As the musical director of the San Francisco Symphony Orchestra, Michael Tilson Thomas has recently organized a series that honors those mavericks, and he's even called it American Mavericks. The four-concert series begins tomorrow at Zankel Hall, which is part of Carnegie Hall, and I'm very pleased it has brought Michael Tilson Thomas back to our show today. Hello.
Nice to see you, Leonard. Good to be back here.
But although I said the series' official beginning is tomorrow night, since the beginning of this month, haven't there been other programs in town with maverick ensembles and composers?
I believe Carnegie Hall has presented some other events under their general umbrella. But the center of this really goes back to the festival that some 12 years ago we launched in San Francisco, dedicated to these composers. And at that time, there were some more of them even with us. And it's curious as I'm reflecting on this, because coming back to this music again, it's a very personal thing for me, because I knew lots of these composers personally, just as you knew all these great painter figures. You know, so it's special somehow when you hear some of these people sing the music to you and express their ideas in their own voice. You see the music on the page, but I think there's a special savor and kind of sense of the kind of exultant defiance that many of them had.
Although you obviously couldn't have known Charles Ives, but
he's one I didn't know.
But I'm sure you would have loved to have met him. He just sounds like one of the most fascinating figures, and we'll get to him in a moment. But in case listeners can't attend, will also be broadcast live into the green space and by our sister station, Q2.
That's right. That's so terrific.
So you think this is the wave of the future, like the Metropolitan Opera's simulcasts in theaters across the country, and a chance to bring music to the kinds of communities that may have had orchestras in the past, but because of the tight economy have been losing them?
I suppose that's possible. I hate the idea of live musical performances and musicians being displaced by something that becomes
but that's a reality, you know, isn't
more
it?
Syndicated. But it's also a special experience. Very often when you hear a live broadcast, there has been some editing involved in it. They've taken three or four live performances and put them together, which is, of course, a great idea as far as getting clear text of the music. But from the audience's point of view, it doesn't perhaps have quite the same excitement. But nonetheless, some of these pieces, it's rare to have performed, especially by the size forces that were involved here.
We do have links to all the concerts and to Q2 Music. How did you come up with the idea of the series? You said a dozen years ago?
Yes, but it goes back earlier than that. I mean, really, back in L.A., where I started my musical life, of course, Stravinsky was alive, and I was very much part of the circle of people around him in the Monday evening concerts.
And a lot of the composers, the great composers, wound up in L.A. because they also once in a while wrote music for some of the movies.
Oh, or hoped to write.
There was
music.
A whole community there, wasn't there?
Yes. I mean, Schoenberg and Stravinsky maybe hoped that they would get a movie deal, which, of course, they never did.
Well, Schoenberg, as I understand, demanded Final Cut, and I don't think that too many studios would allow that for the guy who wrote the music.
Yeah, exactly. But in that series there in Los Angeles, Monday Evening Concerts, a lot of very new music was presented, and a lot of that was music by Ives and Ruggles and Cage and other people. So from the time I was really 12 or 14 years old, I was quite wrapped up in all that.
Aren't most of the best artists and composers mavericks in one way or another? Do we have to define maverick in the case of music?
Well, perhaps we accept that musical revolutionaries have been very much part of the scene since, anyway, the 19th century, or maybe even back into the 18th century. Of course, particularly here in the United States, you must remember that 100 or so years ago, there was a very powerful musical establishment in the country as represented by composers, very serious and sincere composers like Edward McDowell, and there was a whole culture that surrounded them, including Etude Music Magazine and a whole society of concerts being given in musical salons and whatnot across America. So to have somebody like Ives or Cowell or people like this come along with such shatteringly different ideas about what music should investigate, what music should witness, some of the terror and exaltation of life, not just the decorative side of life. That was a very maverick position.
Although it didn't gain Ives very much much fame as a composer, he made his living as an insurance executive, didn't he?
He did, but he was he was very active, of course, in his mind as a musician. And the extraordinary thing about Ives is that within his music, really all of the rest of American music is there. So that if you look through Charles Ives' music, you can find a John Adams moment and a Morton Feldman moment and a Gershwin moment and a Elliot Carter moment. It's like the whole history of what was going to happen in American music is something he at one time or another explored.
How did that even happen? Because he was doing it simultaneously or even before much of what was going on in Europe. He told a story about his father getting him to expand his thinking about music. But is that what it takes?
Well, he was obviously a uniquely talented person and with an amazing background because of his father's Civil War bandsman experience. So he had a great subtext for writing music. My dad used to say there are only two things that count in music, what and how. So Charles Ives had a tremendous amount of what already, what it was about, the America that he wanted to keep touch with. And he developed an extraordinarily amazing how. And this piece we're doing, which is an orchestration of the Concord Sonata, arguably his greatest piece, done by Henry Brandt, who was himself a remarkable American Mavericks composer that San Francisco has done a lot with. And this orchestration, I think, presents a very, very powerful vision of the piece. I'm convinced that this piece will find a place in the standard repertoire. It really blows people away. It's a totally virtuoso orchestra piece, and people are moved to tears by portions of it. It's powerful stuff of the sort of brooding nature of what Ives is thinking about, what's been lost in the soul of America, and as Emerson did, both defying the fates that have made that happen and at the same time trying to reconnect with the poetry of the original experience.
Are conductors often the advocates of these composers' work? I'm thinking about Leopold Stokowski rescuing Ives' Symphony No. 4.
Absolutely. I think it's one of our more important roles.
Is that part of your job?
Oh, sure. That's what I think. In the case of a lot of the music that's on this festival, it's been also associated with editions of the music which have come forward and music that in some cases, as you said, has been rescued from a kind of oblivion. And there's still a lot of work to be done in that area to preserve our cultural heritage.
My guest is Michael Tilson Thomas, whose series American Mavericks begins for concerts tomorrow night at Zankel Hall. What we've heard over the years is a lot of musicians want to play new music, conductors want to conduct it, but the audiences don't want to come. Is that changing? Are we seeing a demographic shift?
Where people are caring about it, it's changing. I'm very proud to say in San Francisco, we have a real public for new music now. And these programs, which are being done just once here in New York, each one of them, have been done multiple times in San Francisco, and large audiences have attended them. But we've worked on that relationship over years. And what's exciting to me is that in this festival here in New York, so many amazing artists are joining us. Tomorrow night's performance has a performance of Cage's Songbooks, a piece which I originally did with Kathy Berberian in the 1970s. And now there are three amazing singers, Meredith Monk, Joan LaBarbera, and Jesse Norman. And Jesse, my dear old friend of so many performances of Mahler and Berg and Berlioz, and I knew that she had an extraordinary spirit, an investigative spirit of exploring new territory. And over a year ago, we began talking about this project, and she's had close contact with both of these ladies. And together, they're weaving a very special vision of John's piece. It's elegant and surprising and mournful, and it amazes me every time we do it. And, of course, every time we do it, it's a bit different because it involves John's ideas of randomness and indeterminacy.
It's almost, in some ways, like performing jazz where you never know where it's going to go. But Charles Ives did that way back when with something like The Unanswered Question, didn't he?
Yes. Well, I mean, that piece is has a certain floating aspect to it. Some of the music is in one time stream and others is in another time stream. But it's been really interesting to watch Jesse and Meredith and Joan work out this process. It began with our all working individually in some detail on what each song would be. And of course, there are songs that are actually theater pieces. So that's become a whole element of the work as well. And the musicians are also taking part in those theater pieces. And there's a whole video installation element of it. So it really kind of evokes that world, that wonderfully wacky world of the 70s that I remember being a part of.
Well, that the songbooks requires performers to perform a repetitive action. And you chose to chop vegetables and put them in a blender at a recent performance in San Francisco.
Well, I did, but that actually was not the actual... What I was doing was the song that says, make something to eat.
Uh-huh. So you were getting literal about it. Do you think that... I'm sure John Cage would have loved the idea of a performer taking his instructions that far.
Oh, well, he wanted that. I mean, I worked a lot with John and sat beside him during many performances. And he had, of course, this impish kind of Zen master impish view of the world. And I think he would be very pleased to see musicians turning their enormous talents toward thinking about the enigmatic instructions that he sometimes gives you.
Now, as part of the festival, the group So Percussion will be leading a celebration of Cage's music. And percussion seems to be one of the prominent aspects to modern composition. Do you see some kind of connection between percussion and these maverick composers?
Well, because many of the maverick composers were interested in world music.
Stravinsky and Bartok probably were the two modern composers who most featured percussion.
Yes, they feature percussion. Of course, Stravinsky only wrote one piece that's exclusively for percussion instruments, Les Noces, Svadyapka. Stravinsky ultimately, as most master musicians are, was more interested in pitch because the treasure of music relies in the relationship of the notes. Mm-hmm. The rhythms are nice and fun, but the even Cage and Cowell and Harrison's involvement with percussion instruments was more because of the sonorities rather than the rhythmic drives of things. And Cage particularly was an explorer of most elusive and poetic kinds of sounds when he himself was choosing the notes.
Mason Bates is one of the composers whose work he'll be performing, and he also works with the YouTube Symphony. Does the internet offer a composer a new way of gaining recognition?
Yes. Well, as you may remember, that I was the music director of those two YouTube symphonies, and Mason was from the beginning part of the project as we were looking for composers who would combine something, particularly in his case, the whole electronic side of things that comes from the DJ culture along with serious musical ideas.
And are we seeing more and more the influence of rock and jazz? Well, jazz has been there for a while, but young composers who grew up listening to rock music?
Oh, sure. I mean, you can hear that in composers from all over the world. I mean, the thing about classical music is that it has encountered over the last 1,200 years every musical style of every ethnicity, and it has absorbed all of that, abstracted it and absorbed it and made it a part of its ongoing musical language. That's what's exciting about it.
You also have been the host of a PBS series called Keeping the Score.
Keeping Score.
Keeping Score.
That's it.
And that in that you looked in the lives and work of great composers. Are conductors teachers as well? I mean, I'm thinking back to Leonard Bernstein, of course, and the marvelous things he did. More in New York, we have Wynton Marsalis also doing something similar with jazz.
And your question, I'm sorry,
I always thought a conductor's job was to get up there and get the orchestra to all play together, but it seems like you have so many other responsibilities.
Well, I think musicians have to be music communicators as well, and something like classical music, which is a wonderful language that needs to be experienced and shared. And we all, as performers, have a role in doing that, I think.
We're going to go out with something by Mason Bates, the B-sides, recorded live at Davis Symphony Hall. My great thanks to Michael Tilson Thomas, whose series American Mavericks begins tomorrow night at Zankel Hall at Carnegie Hall. You can also attend it at the Green Space, or you can hear it streamed live on QXR's Q2 Music. And I thank you so much for being with us. And stay in New York a little longer this time.
I hope you'll come hear one of these shows. They're amazing.